Hi everyone, welcome back to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley. I'm really excited for today's guest. We are going to talk about psychedelic retreats that are helping people heal from all sorts of things like PTSD. First, before we get into it, a couple of announcements. Head over to the links in the show notes. You're going to find ways to connect with my amazing guest, ways to connect with me. You'll find freebies, downloads, courses, coaching links, ways to sponsor the podcast. You'll find a link to my book, Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality. It was endorsed by three people from the film The Secret. It was endorsed by John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Anita Morjani, who wrote Dying to Be Me, so check it out. And as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. We are doing massive things in personal development. We have amazing retreats, we're going to talk about retreats today. We have amazing events about once a month. I was just on stage with Les Brown, Dr. Joe Vitale, Jim Quick, Joseph McClendon. So we have amazing things going on, incredible podcasts in the network. Come check us out. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality and mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science, diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools, and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right, I'm excited to have Neil Markey with me. So Neil Markey is the co-founder and CEO of Beckley Retreats, the world's only psychedelics retreat program backed by 25 years of scientific research and an ecosystem of expertise that honors global wisdom traditions. A former captain in the U.S. Army Special Operations 2nd Ranger Battalion, Neil served in Iraq and Afghanistan before studying at Columbia University, where he struggled with depression and PTSD. This led him to explore mindfulness and psychedelics as part of his healing journey. Prior to Beckley, he was chief growth officer for a $450 million private equity portfolio company and a consultant at McKinsey & Company. Neil believes in the synergy between science and spirituality, which is kind of what my podcast is about. So welcome, Neil. I'm excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's, I think, a good fit.
I love this day and age where science is backing up what mysticism and spirituality has been saying for eons. It's so exciting.
Right? I know. It's an amazing time to be alive, and we're realizing that, yeah, the mystics have been onto something for quite some time.
Totally. So I always start my show off the same way by asking my guests what their origin story is. And I know I kind of covered a little bit of it in your bio, but I'd love for you to just give me an idea of what led you to open this company. What was your own journey with psychedelics like?
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. I was studying math at University of Maryland, and then September 11th happened. And I ended up joining the officer program thinking I was doing the right thing. I wanted to help. And I went in as a lieutenant and then ended up in Iraq. By the time I got to Iraq, you know, went through school and training and then got to my unit and then deployed. We had learned that this whole weapons of mass destruction thing was not accurate. And so it was really a challenging time to be there. And then I got a chance to go be part of a special operations unit called the Ranger Regiment, went to Afghanistan twice with them. And part of me loved it. It was super adventurous, and I really looked up to the guys that I was serving with. And now looking back, it was just wildly traumatic. You know, I mean, I think everybody in the entire unit had some level of PTSD, some worse, some worse than others. And then I was just burnt out, and I got out in 2012 and went to grad school, and then by some measures was doing okay professionally. Like, I was at a good school and was showing up in some ways, but then was also really struggling, was having trouble in my relationships. I was having trouble sleeping. I was having some anger issues, and I cycled through a bunch of different traditional approaches, SSRIs, anti-anxiety medications, sleeping pills, and didn't have a whole lot of benefit. And then the thing that was pivotal for me was meditation. I got introduced to meditation. I just knew I needed it and had the discipline to just sit. And then through that network, had the chance to have some professionally facilitated psychedelic experiences. And it felt like they were almost like accelerating what I was trying to do with meditation in some ways, or enhancing that. And that was 13 years ago. And that was kind of the beginning of me trying this different way of being. And then between now and then, I mean, there was a bit of a corporate stint and a bunch of other things, but that was kind of the beginning of it, was that transition. Rock bottom, if you will, makes you, there's that Rumi quote, when you're on your knees is a good time to pray, you know, a lot of clarity when you're begging for things to change.
Yeah, and you're like reaching for something. Thank you for sharing that. I feel like war is one of those things where it's like everyone understands that there's like how could a human being go through that and not come out traumatized? And we've all seen war movies, but it's like, I don't think anyone could actually understand unless they've gone through that experience. So I can't even imagine how traumatic that was for you. And what, just really quickly, like, what was the vibe in your unit? Like, once you guys realized that the weapons of mass destruction thing wasn't really a thing.
Well, when I was in the regular army, and I was in Iraq, it was, I don't know, it was really disheartening. I mean, everybody was kind of agreeing to just show up and fake it, because you had to show up for your, what were now friends and coworkers, and as a leader, you know, you're responsible for the people that, you know, are under your command. And so you have to inspire them and tell them that they're doing something of meaning. But yeah, you have this reality in the background, which was, we probably made the worst foreign policy decision in American history. And now we're in the midst of this like incredible mess of civil war. And so it was sad, you know, it was really sad. It was really, it felt meaningless. And then when I was in the Rangers, that was in some ways easier to get on board with, because it was a more precise mission. We were going after very specific individuals. And so I actually felt like that, you know, had some purpose, but my whole thoughts on the Western military industrial complex and all these bigger things has changed dramatically over time. And I hope that we don't get ourselves into these like long drawn out wars anymore. It's just such a waste of life and resources. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's interesting. So thanks for sharing that. I mean, looking back, I'm imagining like, you've probably killed people, right? To just like be blunt about it. Like, now that you're more spiritually minded, like how do you kind of navigate that? Like, have you found something in spirituality that has helped you kind of process that?
Yeah. And yeah, it's, I feel like I've asked for forgiveness and have been given forgiveness, And I also still believe that there's real evil in the world, and it's hard for me to kind of know that and then, you know, not support people that are a counter to that force. I guess I just know for me, I don't want to do it in my life for the rest of my life. Like, I don't want to be involved in it. That's like a personal decision.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough. I mean, like, there's a, what's the Bible? What did Jesus say? You know, if you get struck on the cheek, you give the other cheek. But then there's a point to where you don't, you know, there's a number. I think it was 40 some times you're supposed to give the other cheek. But then even in a lot of the spiritual traditions, it doesn't necessarily mean like just fall over and give up, you know? So to me, there's this, you can be spiritually attuned and also still have some sense of kind of a warrior spirit of sorts, you know, and take care of the people that are close to you, but it's less aggressive, you know, it's more stable and present and, you know, not seeking to prove something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope when you were going around forgiving everyone else and asking for forgiveness, you forgave yourself too, because that's a really big component of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I asked that, and I appreciate your just like very genuine response, because it's something like I've thought about a lot. I've gone down so many rabbit holes of like people who've had NDEs, and I'm actually working on a documentary about it, but so many people who have had NDEs have come back basically saying like they've lost their ability to judge right and wrong, because they don't see victims and perpetrators anymore. They see people who are healed and who are like emotionally sick, and they're coming from this perpetuated cycle of like the victim who now victimizes, and they can now see that we're all one and we're all connected. And I believe that so wholeheartedly. But you know, if they're out there hurting other people, like you said, like, how do you find that balance?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, you know, to me, if, this idea of God or oneness or the field or whatever, this infinite thing where everything is everything, that then created this existence where there was a duality, where the things were this but not that, you know, in order to have this world, we had to have light and dark, we had to have good and bad, we had to have hot and cold, we had to, that's like the definition of it. So I don't know, maybe if you zoom out far enough, things are happening just as they should. And but it's hard to be a human and see horrible things and not have like a emotional reaction to it, you know. I don't know, that evolved perspective where it doesn't bother you and you just see it as the natural course of things. I don't know, it seems like it's kind of overly numb or something sometimes too, you know. And I don't know if that's like my aspiration, to be able to like look at horrible things and be like, well, it's just the way the world is, and not have a emotional response. I think that's what makes us human, you know? So
totally. There's that idea that like all that duality you're talking about is for lessons so that we can learn and level up and grow as souls. But I also think like, to your point, you know, like maybe we're here to like help create a better world, right? So like there has to be like some sort of action, right? We can't just kind of like passively bury our heads in the sand. But it's tough, like you said, like none of us, most people don't want to see another person suffering.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've listened to any of like Nassim Haramim's stuff, or Zach Bush talks about this, but you can find a lot of similarities if you go down a level. Like if you look at the cellular level and then you kind of zoom up and you look at the human level. And so to give an example, there's lots of different kind of single cell organisms where there's a life cycle where they go through a period of strife and there's a lot of infighting. And that is what allows them to evolve. And then they get into this more static state where things are more resonant, and then they just chill. And you could make an argument that humanity is going through this period where there's this strife, but like through that will come a period where there's more equilibrium. And I don't know, I hold on to that. I can see that. I believe that to be possible.
I love that so much. Thanks for bringing a scientific lens into it, because so many mystics and spirituality says the same thing. Like, we're headed towards this quote unquote new earth, right? Where things are going to be a lot more peaceful. And it's cool to hear it. It's cool to hear it from that angle as well. Did it just get really staticky for you?
No, I'm good.
Weird. I just heard a lot of static. Yeah, cool. So back to the plants. Which plant did you try first, or is there only one that you've done?
Mushrooms was first, and that's probably my favorite's the wrong word, but I feel closest to mushrooms. And then I've tried many different compounds over the last 10 years, but I still think mushrooms have a really special place. And then a few years ago, or it's been more than a few now, but at the early days of this adventure, which was not a normal undertaking, a lot of people told me that I was doing something that was borderline nuts. I kind of, in a bit of desperation, kind of was like, can I get a signal, or can I get some clarity that I'm working on the right things? And then, I don't know, a month or so later, there was a Rolling Stone article about National Psychedelic Mushroom Day was my birthday. And I was like, okay, I'll take that.
And I love it. You told me before the show you were in Costa Rica, and I totally just remembered. I know a girl who, I don't know if she's still there, but she was in Costa Rica for years doing Ibogaine treatments for vets. Have you tried Ibogaine before?
I haven't done Ibogaine myself, but I've worked closely with a company called The Mission Within, and this Dr. Martin Polanco, who's a legend, and they do Ibogaine for veterans. So I've been quite close to it. And I think I'll do Ibogaine this year. I think I'll try it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just from following her posts on Facebook, she's just seen like amazing results from it.
It's miraculous. And even if you listen to the scientists talk about it, there was just a big study last year by Nolan Williams at Stanford. And from like a pharmacological perspective, you know, they say that there's been like all of these different compounds up until this point. And then like Ibogaine is in a league that we've never seen before. It has more mechanisms of action than like anything by an order of magnitude. So it's like a,
wow,
it's a phenomenal compound, and we're just starting to kind of understand it.
But like more than ayahuasca?
Yeah, much more.
Wow.
Much more. And so it's doing stuff in the brain, it's doing stuff in the gut, it's doing stuff in the central nervous system. I mean, it's like, it's touching everything, and it really is. I mean, again, all of these compounds have risks, and you know, nothing is like a panacea. It doesn't work for everyone or everything, but for some indications, it looks like Ibogaine is close to a miraculous compound as we've ever seen. And so people that have like severe complex PTSD, and I've seen this, guys can't get out of bed, multiple suicide attempts, you know, you figure out a way to get them on the plane, you get them down to a program, and they come out the other side of the program, they look different. They like, there's been guys that like, because of the inflammation in the body and all these things are interlinked, like couldn't touch their toes. And then after 1 week can easily touch their toes. Like the body has literally released, and they go back home and love on their kids and their wife. Like they're a whole different person. It's unbelievable. You know, it really is. So it's exciting to see that there's more openness to it. And this opioid use disorder, I mean, my God, what a tragedy in the States. And it looks like it's really beneficial for severe addiction too. Wow. So yeah, it's encouraging.
That's amazing. What is ibogaine exactly? I don't even know like what plant it comes from.
It comes from a root that grows in Africa. And so it's part of a few different tribes' indigenous spiritual traditions. And they've used it for thousands of years as a way to connect spiritually and heal the warriors. And so, yeah, it's a pretty magical plant. And so then that's the iboga plant. And then if it's synthesized in a certain way, then you can make ibogaine, which is like a more sterile version. Like just like how you can take a mushroom, you can synthesize out the psilocybin and give someone just psilocybin. You can do that with iboga and make ibogaine.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's cool. It makes you wonder, like, who was the first person to try these things, right? Or is it just right? Like, I don't know. It's just like passed down through wisdom. Okay, so let's talk about your first mushroom experience. Did you just do it by yourself? Did you do it with some sort of healer, like in a ceremony? What was it?
It was with a facilitator, and it was kind of the clinical trial approach, although it was on the underground, so it was in a room on a bed with a blindfold and a headphones. It was a lot of Enya music. And so I always like, will always have a very special place in my heart for Enya. But yeah, that was the first one.
That's so funny. So my special place with Enya is when I was in high school, we had to like do swimming, which we all hated as like part of our gym class. And then once a week they would turn all the lights off in the like swimming pool area and let us like float, and they would blast Enya, and it was like the best thing ever.
Yeah.
So I would be like, oh, I have my period every day except for like that day, and like get out of swim, but like loved that.
Yeah.
Gotta love Enya. So was it like, what was so transformative about that first experience with mushrooms?
Yeah. It was just like this central nervous system kind of like release. Like I felt like in some ways I was walking around with my fists clenched because I had kind of trained to be a certain way for so long. And then that was hard to kind of get out of that. And I felt like I was finally like, and so I felt that. And then not in that first mushroom experience, but in ones later, I realized that, you know, so I was quite fortunate, like in the spectrum of like military experiences. I was an officer, and when I was in the Rangers, I was more on like the planning side. So I was a little bit removed from like the worst of the worst of it, but was still in like these units where it was quite intense. And I realized that part of what was still causing me some like issue where I was having symptoms was we would get rocketed at night. And so you would be asleep. And then all of a sudden you would wake up to these explosions, and you would have to quickly like grab your rifle and grab your boots and get out of your little bunk and go get into a bunker. And it was just like and I saw in one of the sessions that like, there was something for me that was specific around the risk of being being asleep and being attacked. And I was able to see that it wasn't as much like the stuff that was happening and I was around when I was awake, like my body was ready for that. I was aware, but something was pretty deep. And when I was like in a vulnerable position and then woke up to, you know, life threatening things, and just the awareness of that then kind of allowed it to shift a little bit, and me to be able to be like, when I'm in bed, be like, okay, you know, I'm in the United States. I'm not going to get bombed. It's like, I can actually like allow my body to not be in this reactive mode. So I think for many, it's kind of, you get this insight into where the trauma lies, and like, it'll kind of come up to the surface again. And then, if it's properly facilitated and you're working with someone that can help you navigate it, then you can kind of develop a little bit different relationship with it. You can kind of meet it and accept it and thank it for, you know, the benefit that it did provide, but then, you know, let it be, and it doesn't, you don't need to carry it anymore. And those things with just talk therapy and kind of regular approaches, they can be really hard to figure out exactly where it is or like where it's stuck. But these experiences have some way, we don't really understand the mechanics, but like some way of bringing these things to the surface. And then there's some potential there.
That's really fascinating. And I can't even imagine. You probably like didn't allow yourself to go into like a deep sleep, and it's like sleep is so restorative. Like you connect back with source, right, while you're asleep.
100%.
And so I'm sure like there was like some sort of like tether kind of broken off there. Like that's such a like integral part of life, right?
Yeah. All these symptoms, like people that have PTSD, TBI. If you go and look at their sleep, you're seeing it in their sleep, you know? And I think, like you said, there's a bit of a reinforcing loop there. But, you know, if you're not getting that like deep restorative sleep, and I agree with you, connecting back to source in some way, then it just makes everything worse, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really hard to kind of break that cycle.
Yeah. And I like what you were saying about how, like, you know, anyone that's gone through any, and not to the level of, you know, people who have seen war, but like most people who have gone through some sort of trauma in their life to the extent that it like sits in their body somewhere. And I like that what you were saying is like traditional talk therapy and stuff. It's like, sometimes you don't even know what's upsetting you or what's causing symptoms, right? And and you definitely don't know where it's stuck in your body. And I love your story about the people on Ibogaine who suddenly could touch their toes, because it's like that book, The Body Keeps the Score. I don't know if you've read it, but it's like, it's such a good one, right? But it's like, like your body really does hold on to all of this. And it makes sense that like this plant medicine would kind of like help uproot it, because it's so tapped into your unconscious, right? Because most of the time we're not conscious of this.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And like, I'm so interested in some of the kind of cutting edge research around these things. But so often if you find like some emotional kind of dysregulation, there'll be some physical manifestation of that somewhere in the body. And you'll see it show up as like gut fungus or bacterial overgrowth or inflammation, right? And so you can, it's a loop, you know? So I think like if you look at this, the biofield research, which is so fascinating, is below the atomic level, there's a level which has a field that has energy and information in it, and we're getting better at being able to measure this. But our experiences and things, when we have traumatic experiences, there's something that happens at that energetic level, and there's memory there, and then there's memory at like the cellular level, and then there's memory and awareness like at our body kind of consciousness level. And there's different techniques and different interventions, and you have to kind of treat all those different levels, because they all are loops. They all inform each other, you know? And so if you're just at the human consciousness level, you know, you're getting that one part of it, but there's actually stuff that's like down in the tissues. And then arguably there's stuff that's even one level below that, that's at this like field level, that we're starting to learn that, okay, you can maybe hit it with some different vibrations, or just through consciousness awareness and being present in some of these different energy modalities like Reiki, and you can get at that level. And if you do all of those things, you know, you can have a better chance of helping somebody make change that sticks.
Yeah, so fascinating.
It's really cool.
And like, to that point, that all of this starts like energetically and then like gets stored in your body, like pretty much like anyone that's holding on to repressed emotions for long enough, like will develop illness of some kind, right? Not just like the mental and psychiatric and emotional, but like physical illness. Physical, it will manifest in your body.
Yeah, right? Disease, dis-ease.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like all these kind of autoimmune diseases, there's I think compelling research that says exactly what you're saying, is that there's some memory or consciousness or awareness that's stuck, that then is coming up through that energetic field into the cellular level and then creating disbalance there, and then that shows up as cancer or inflammation or you name it, oversensitivity. So yeah, it's all these things are linked, you know.
Have you had anyone, because you run retreats, like have you had anyone come to you with like a physical illness that then got resolved after doing plant medicine?
Yeah, we've had some, you know, we don't know if it's causal, because it's, you know, you've got to kind of do things in a specific way to say if what we did is the thing that created these changes. But to give an example of something that, we had a woman come through a program, and she came for, most of our people, the people that come through our programs are coming for personal professional development. Like they're doing okay. They want to become more empathetic. They want to be connected more, these types of things. And so that's why she was there. But then after the program, she went back and got her labs done and had a kidney condition for 20 some years, and had never been able to get it resolved. And it was her levels were normal.
Wow.
And so it could be completely coincidental. We don't know, but there's things like that happen that I hope that like we as a field can try and study more. But I think it's probably, I mean, I believe that these miraculous things can happen, and miraculous things do happen all the time. And, you know, these types of experiences maybe are getting at that root level. And if you kind of solve things at that root level, then you can make pretty dramatic change.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how do you, what about fear? I'm just thinking back to myself. So I went through my own PTSD from being sexually abused for 4 years. And part of like my, like acting out during that is like, I used to do a lot of drugs, and that's including like psychedelics. So I don't even know how many times I've done mushrooms and acid and all these things. But the last time I did mushrooms, I had a really bad trip, and I have like fear around it. Like I would love to go do an ayahuasca ceremony, like with like an actual ceremony, but I have this fear after this bad trip. So like, how do you navigate that?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, fear is your body trying to tell you something, and you should listen. And then, you know, but then in some ways that fear doesn't mean you don't move forward. It means you pay attention and try and tune in and understand what's happening there. And so I would listen to that. I mean, a lot of our guests, it's their first time doing something like this. And so there's quite a bit of reservation and anxiety, and you know, we let them know that that's normal. But we also don't try and convince people to come. I mean, you know, I think it's such a personal thing, and that's these experiences too. They I forget who it was, Robin Carhart Harris maybe, that was like, psychedelics are definitely not for people that don't want to do them. Like that's for sure, you know. And so there's these kind of regular Western medical interventions that don't require as much of like a conscious buy-in from the participant, you know, like you can take a vitamin and your conscious awareness probably could help the vitamin, but like it's not required. But like with psychedelics, for it to be a good, meaningful, positive experience, like that person has to be in the right mindset, and there has to be some buy-in there, you know, so it's so personal. And I think we're still trying to figure out how best to help people make that decision for themselves. But also know that, like, you know, the some fear and anxiety is normal, but there's a point to where you shouldn't push it. You know, it's just, it might not be, it's not for everyone, and, you know, nothing is.
Yeah, I remember reading DMT, the spirit molecule, like years ago. And like most of the experiences were positive, but there's like one or two kind of fucked up ones, right? Yeah. And they even said it, like, a lot of it had to do with the mindset going in.
Yeah. Well, I think broadly right now, to me, there's a difference between kind of like traumatic experiences and challenging experiences. And I would say traumatic experiences are ones where if you ask the person a few months later, would they do it again? And they would say no. That was, it was all downside. I think with psychedelics, if you do all the right things, if you properly screen, if you properly prepare, if you have really good facilitation, if you write set and setting, you do all those things, you can really minimize the traumatic experiences. Can you get it to zero? No. I don't think there's anything that you can kind of like get to zero. But you can get that to a very low number. And then it's comparing the risk profile and the potential benefit profile of this experience versus other experiences that humans do, which include the risk profile of pharmaceutical drugs or driving at night or climbing a mountain. And like they all have gives and takes. And I think what we try and do is just give people all the information and be super open book and then allow people to make their own decision. On the challenging experiences side, it's something like 20 to 30% of people have challenging experiences. So like if anybody,
probably what they need though, right?
Well, that's the thing. Like those people would months later say that was rough. That was a lot of work, but I think there was value in it and I got through it. But I think it's good for people to know that many people don't have like a cupcakes and rainbows experience when they're doing this. For many people, it's like there's some darkness and there's some pain and there's some struggle. But for many, there's a light at the end of that and they're able to kind of work through that and be better on the other side. But
did you ever have any of those experiences where there was work and struggle in it?
Yeah, for sure.
What did that look like for you?
Well, I've had some experiences where it's just like, it's just dark where, you know, you kind of get to this point where this is all like, we're all just, it's meaningless, you know, It's just, it's empty. And I'm trying to think of some of my other, you know, you get things brought to your awareness from ways that, you know, you interacted or did things in the past that you're shameful of or not proud of. And it's like right in your face and it'll spin it around 20 different ways and have you look at it from this way. And you see it from your mom's eyes and from your partner's eyes. And you just like, wow, I was a real piece of shit in that period. And you feel horrible, you know, but then all that was in there. Right. It was all in there. Now it's more at the surface and you can go through some process of forgiving yourself or going and actually seeking forgiveness from people that maybe that you need to go do that from. And then, you know, you can move through it. But a lot of us have some things in our past that we're not super proud of and we've tucked them away and we've managed it. And then they get brought up.
Just going back to the NDE thing, like that's one of the things that like so many people have had NDEs experience the life review, but they see it through all the other people who are involved's point of view.
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, it's like the golden rule, like written into the fabric of the universe.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And what a, like a, I mean, you can say it all day long and talk about it and do it at that mental level. But then when you have a lived experience where you live that, that changes how you act, you know? That's way easier or way harder to kind of like disregard and push to the side when you have like a very real memory of, you know, getting all those different perspectives of being a good or bad person, you know?
So it's such a gift to like be able to then like change in this lifetime, right? Because yeah. It's like we, like you said, like we all know how we should treat other people, and we all have treated other people badly, or like whether we are meaning to or not, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, pretty wild.
Wild.
So what's the facilitator's job? Like, how does someone facilitate this? Like, how many people are in the retreat together? Like, what does it look like?
Usually our groups are 15 guests, and then we'll have a maximum of 3 guests to 1 facilitator ratio. So our normal team size is 5, and each team has a lead. All of our leads are either medical doctors or psychotherapists.
That's cool.
Now they're not operating in their medical capacity because we're not diagnosing or treating anything, but they have that training and framework. And, you know, frankly, part of the reason why it matters is because those credentials make people feel safe. And so you kind of do whatever it takes to make people feel safe. And we're brought up in this Western world where letters after people's names mean something. And so, you know, that's, and that the knowledge that they have, and the work experience they have working with people is valuable. But where there's a, in this work, you know, the present state of that individual, I would say, is more important than what they know. So how they are. So in medicine, you would see this talked about as maybe like doctor bedside manner or something like this, right? And so how they make people feel, their presence. I hope we can measure this more. I think you can actually like get some indications through different wearables and different devices of like how balanced someone's central nervous system is. So ultimately, we're looking for people that have, you know, good, clear training in a related field, a lot of experience doing this group work, and then what's their state of being and how do they make people feel? And we evaluate that, you know, really through like apprenticeship and making sure that we get a lot of touch points with them and they get to work with the teams and get feedback. And, but yeah, that's the really important part is, the presence, which is sometimes forgotten about in Western medicine, where you go in and it's like an algorithm and it's just check, 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 check. And a lot of what people need is human connection and to be seen and heard and felt.
Especially in such a vulnerable state. And that is so smart of you to have psychotherapists and doctors. Like, even someone who questions the medical industry so much, that would make me feel safer.
Yeah, how we're brought up. What's interesting though is sometimes, and we've seen this, you'll have someone that is a medical doctor that's worked in the field, like the established field, for a long time, and they're used to being in their mind a lot and pathologizing and trying to problem solve, which is different than being present and allowing and witnessing. And so we've had incredibly credentialed MDs and stuff want to come work with us, and then you realize, oh, there's actually some unlearning here, or there's some additional kind of training that's required to allow them to get out of their mind, you know?
It makes sense.
And allow things to be. And I think for our experiences too, we're trying to create a safe environment for people to go through these experiences supported, but they're kind of going through it on the mushrooms are giving them an experience, and we're creating a safe environment for them to go through that experience on their own. And so there's this, you know, you're kind of sitting back a little bit and allowing, you know, and sometimes people will cry or will laugh or have all kinds of like big emotions. And in a traditional context, people are wired, they'll want to go immediately intervene and be like, can I help? What's happening? And then they'll want to get into the mind and problem solve with that individual, where I think that the more ideal way for these types of experiences is you're one step back. And when, if people need help and they call for help, then you help, but you also kind of allow the process, you know, you allow there to be a little bit of struggle, and that's okay, because that's the stuff coming up, you know, you don't want to intervene and stop that from happening. That's what you want. So you kind of let people work through that.
Yeah, totally. You don't want to like stop their experience. So, I mean, okay. So what's like the dosage? Because I'm wondering, like, I'm just thinking about like all the times I've done mushrooms, like I'm still pretty aware. And if you have 15 people in a room, like, I mean, are people like talking to each other? Are they just like, do they have the headphones and the eye mask on? Like you said, like what, like paint the picture for me.
Everybody's in a group. But you have your own kind of arrangement, mat, pillows, and you kind of get comfortable, and then we play live music. And,
cool.
And so it's a really kind of, it's different than if you did this in a doctor's office, you know, there's more art to it, I would say. And, you know, so we have musicians and they've all played these songs before, but they're also, they're improvising. So like if the group is kind of going this way and they want the group to kind of come back this way, they play these songs, and sometimes they'll intentionally sit and let it be silent and you just hear nature. And so, you know, we're encouraging this kind of artistry because we think that it's really valuable. We don't just put on the Johns Hopkins playlist and crank through that. So everybody's having their own personal experience. You know, they'll be moving, or sometimes people are completely silent. But there's a collective experience, like for sure, you know. And we know this to be true. Like HeartMath has done a lot of this research. Like if we're in a room together, your central nervous system's picking up on mine. We're exchanging a ton of information. And so that's happening kind of at even heightened level amongst all these people. So it's incredibly fascinating to watch. And then, you know, people will want to kind of, they'll want to talk to their friends or whatever. And the facilitators will be like, okay, you know, go put your mask back on, kind of like stay in your space. And then sometimes an individual will have like a big experience and it'll get to a point where it's a bit uncomfortable for them because they feel like they're distracting the group. And they probably are distracting the group to some extent. And so we just have, you know, protocols kind of around that, which is generally you have a couple facilitators, you know, take that individual out to an alternate location, like let them be on their own for a minute because they just need to kind of let it go for a while. And then usually 15 minutes after they can come back in and then they join the group, you know? So it's just, that's why it's important to have facilitators that have done it a bunch of times. So they can kind of like manage all of this with a really balanced central nervous system. They've seen it. It's not a big deal. It's like, kind of keep that safe resonance in the group.
Do you have your facilitators go through it themselves before? Yeah.
And then we have ongoing training programs, and I think we do that really well. And we're really fortunate too. Frankly, we pay really well relative to this industry, and with the Beckley brand, I think is well respected. So facilitators for their own personal professional development like working with Beckley. It's good for their career, which has then allowed us to be super selective. You know,
that's so cool.
Hundreds of people that have, you know, submitted applications. We only have a couple dozen facilitators, and we've been able to just pick some of the best, I think, in the world, frankly.
I mean, that just says like where the consciousness of humanity is right now, that's the case. Because this used to be such a fringe thing.
It's wild how much it's changed in the last 24, 36 months from where I'm sitting. It's encouraging. And there's, you know, it's encouraging and concerning. It's a bit of the, it's new territory. There's a lot of people that are offering these experiences that probably don't have the requisite experience to be doing it, you know, and there's not a central body that is going around and policing all of these individuals and organizations that are doing this, you know, so it's definitely like kind of a buyer beware state right now, you know, like I don't want to be a fear monger because I think, again, relative to a lot of things we do in our normal lives, the risk profile is not wild. But people need to ask a lot of questions because there's risk here, you know, and especially if it's your first time, especially if you think you have like some more, you know, things that have happened that might come up that are on the more significant end of the spectrum. You just want to be thoughtful and cautious and make sure that you do it in a place with people that are really good at what they're doing.
Sure. So do you do this in the States or do you do it down in like Costa Rica or wherever you're?
We have programs in Jamaica and the Netherlands, and it's the two places where you can do mushrooms in the world right now legally. And so we're a US-based company, and we'll do programs in the States, but we're going to wait for something to change at the federal level. And it's a bit unknown right now when that would happen.
Right on. And you only do mushrooms, right?
We only do mushrooms.
Okay.
I think we're going to do some programs that are similar structure. So, you know, big on skill building, teaching people meditation, mindful movement, group format, natural locations, but use ketamine as a accelerant. You can do that today in the States legally. So I think we might test some of those programs. I'm actually a fan of ketamine so long as it's done in the right way. I think that the industry's gotten it a bit wrong where you can just go to these centers and you get a ketamine infusion and there's no therapy around it. There's no skill building around it. There's no community around it. There's no nature connectedness around it. And to me, that's, you know, less than optimal, to say it lightly.
Well, isn't ketamine's not natural though? That's like a pharmaceutical, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's a pharmaceutical.
It's interesting. That's another one I've done many times back in the day. Mm-hmm. So what is it, like, why'd you choose mushrooms? Like, what is it that mushrooms do that other plant medicine doesn't?
So mushrooms, they're one of the safest in relative terms. They're some of the most well-researched, you know, so, and they're also one of the most widely used. So when we're trying to make some assumptions around risk profile, you know, we can be more confident because there's literally been like millions of people that have taken them for thousands of years, you know, and so, and then they work. They're generally well tolerated, you know, so ayahuasca, most people get very ill and it's like it's an intense experience. You could make an argument that that's part of it. I don't disagree with that. But for us, in terms of like having an organization that's running these programs regularly and just trying to have something that's manageable and, you know, consistent, mushrooms, the range of possible outcomes are here. Ayahuasca, I would say the range of possible outcomes is here. So it's just like makes more sense for us. And then there's also, there's, I would say, less conflict around mushrooms, where ayahuasca has more there's more concerns around the indigenous lineages, there's more concerns around the supply chains, there's more concerns around the sustainability. And so not that there aren't those, you know, considerations with mushrooms, but it's less, you know, they're grown many more places, there are many more types, there's a tighter kind of like hold on what makes a proper mushroom session as opposed to an ayahuasca session, if you will. And so it was quite a few different reasons why we've decided on mushrooms.
That totally makes sense from a business standpoint. Do mushrooms and ayahuasca do different things in the body? Do they have different kind of outcomes? Because you were talking about ibogaine works in the gut and the nervous system. Like, what about mushrooms versus ayahuasca?
Yeah. So they're similar but different. And I think that, like, as a field, it's still trying to understand all the different mechanisms of action. I would say, though, generally, it's more, and you'll hear some psychonauts say this too, that, you know, from the 60s and 70s, it's the compound is less than 50% of the experience. More is the set and the setting, the preparation, who you're with, why you're doing it, like all the context. And I think that's true, you know? So these psychedelic compounds are actually like more similar than they are different, and the way in which they're used is the thing that's like the real kind of critical differentiator.
That makes sense. Very cool. So as we start to wrap up, is there anything we didn't touch on today that you would really want to like get out there into the world message wise?
Well, I think, yeah, there's a lot of interest and research and emphasis right now on these compounds and experiences for kind of the more clinical end of the spectrum, treatment-resistant depression, PTSD, and these types of things. And that's great. And we're super supportive of that. Our company is more on the other end of the spectrum, which we would call maybe like the betterment of the well. And so I guess what we're trying to let the world know is that you don't need to have some super severe level indication to get tremendous benefit out of these experiences. You can become more empathetic. You can have more period of or kind of like moments of awe. You can feel more connected to your family members. You can have more creative potential. And so all of these kind of like good to great things, I think that there's application for these experiences too. And that's generally what our programs are for.
I appreciate that, because when we first started talking, I was like, oh, this is totally going to be for vets and people with severe PTSD who have gone through war. So that's cool that it's, open to anyone, and anyone can benefit from it. Yeah. So I'm sure people want to know how they can connect with you, where they can find the website, all the things. So if you want to just take a moment and let people know.
Yeah, it's BeckleyRetreats.com. If you Google Beckley Retreats, we'll come up. The Beckley name comes from the Beckley Foundation, so you can also Google the Beckley Foundation and look at some of the cool research that that organization's done over the last 25 years. And we're trying really hard to be a conscious company, and so we know it's a big decision to do a program like this, and so it's not uncommon for us to speak with someone like 3 or 4 different times. We're happy to do it, you know. You can send us an email. We're super responsive. We'll get on a call with you. We're quite available to help.
That's really cool to hear. And I guess we didn't even touch on, like, how long are these retreats? Like, how long do people go for?
5 nights.
And, oh, wow. Do they do mushrooms every night?
No, just 2 psilocybin sessions. Okay. And then the rest of it is, it's really like an integrative health program. So we're teaching meditation and mindful movement and breathwork exercises and some simple kind of Western psychotherapy stuff, like gratitude practice. If you've never tried it, it's pretty incredible what it can do if you do it for long enough. And so we introduce lots of these little techniques that, and that's part of the magic of these experiences, is that after them, there's some openness, there's like this neuroplasticity that happens. And so I think what it looks like is that if you introduce some of these different ways of thinking and being and different practices, they're more likely to stick. So I think if you just try and take a group of people and get them to start meditating, that's a tough road. I've like done that for a long time. But something special happens after these experiences where people are just more open to it, and they just kind of understand at a deeper level why they would meditate. and then they do it. And so then, you know, you can have sustained benefit because people are actually living differently.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Neil. Thank it was such a pleasure. Yeah, I learned so much. If you are listening, send this to someone you think would like it. Like, comment, share, subscribe, all the things. Let's help lift the consciousness of humanity. I'll see you all next week.